Actually, it's a bit of time piece. You'll all start waving and making the appropriate signs if I go on too long. Thank you, Joe, for the introduction, and thank you very much to Joe and Kathleen and to COSA for the invitation. I really do enjoy coming to the States. I've had a couple of sabbaticals at Cornell and spent a lot of time visiting other universities around here, and it's a wonderful experience to be able to come from New Zealand over to the States. I mean, there's something about the agriculture in the two countries that is... It's the same, but not the same, really. And when you sit on that aeroplane and fly from LA or San Francisco across to the East Coast, and you sort of go over the flyover zone and you look out your window and you start seeing all the different myriad styles of agriculture that are practiced in the United States, it's just an endlessly fascinating country. In some ways, a crystallization of this massive potential site of innovation and activity, and yet also when you start coming into those arid zones and see those little green circles appearing under the plain, also a site of so many of the world's agricultural problems. From New Zealand, what I want to bring you tonight is... a sense in which New Zealand is like a little arc or a microcosm of a particular style of agriculture, and the way in which we, as a couple of islands in the South Pacific, with a particular pasture-based farming system, are demonstrating certain things that are happening in our little patch of the world that might be informative or might create a nice sort of interesting dialogue between ourselves and what's happening in the States. The talk I'm going to give tonight came out of a visit to my research centre by the environmental scientist Jules Pretty. Jules came down for a week to talk about issues around the world food crisis of 2008. And we had a fascinating dialogue. And Jules really challenged us to think very carefully about what agricultural sustainability will have to do in the face of the world food crisis. So he cited the best population ecology that he knows to say that our best future scenario is that we will probably require double the amount of the food we currently produce on planet Earth by about 2050, but we've got to work out a way of doing it sustainably. Or else it'll be earlier than 2050 before we go over the top. And there are various models out there of how to do this. And we talked through the week about, you know, small-scale agriculture's capacity to feed the world, local versus big ag, kind of the dualism that the likes of Michael Pollan puts up and things like that. The question came around to, where does New Zealand fit in this continuum? It's been very interesting being hosted by PASA here, because I'm talking about a style of farming that, in PASA's eyes, seems to have disappeared out of the United States. Medium-sized family farming, highly profitable, engaged, kind of dynamic and happening family farming, which is something I think that rural sociologists in the States have been sort of lamenting and watching the disappearance of for a while. So here's what Jules's challenge was. He said, look, the West does not feed the third world. The hungry people of the world are hungry not because they can't get to their local supermarket and it's not full enough of food, but because they don't have money, they don't have resources, they don't have access to the market relations that provide food for the world. He said, the West is not where the world food crisis will be solved. The world food crisis will be solved in the third world. I was thinking, well, okay, well, there goes our legitimation for pretty well 90% of what passes for agriculture in the West. So what do? Where in that model do developed countries like New Zealand and by implication a large part of the United States fit in a world where you're solving world hunger essentially by revolutionising agriculture in the third world? What do? Do we have a future? I grew up sitting at my grandfather's kitchen table on the farm, back on the old family farm, and he told me from the early 70s on, we're in a good job here, grandson. You know, this is a good thing. Farming is a good industry, it's a moral industry, because we are feeding the hungry people of the world. And I think it's probably with some slight shivering of guilt as I think of my dear departed grandfather that I realize as a professional, of course, highly productive agriculture in New Zealand has never fed the hungry of the world. We're actually a very successful feeder of middle class to wealthy consumers around the world. That's what we do. Right, so the theme tonight, New Zealand, putatively the pastoral organic exporting paradise. Right, there we are. It's quite a long way from Pittsburgh, but I am enjoying being here. There we are. What you see in New Zealand is our two lovely islands, and it's It's a slightly smaller screen than I anticipated, or else I would have blown this up slightly more. Very variegated. Soil scientists love New Zealand because of its extremely heterogeneous soil patterning, all the volcanic, the alluvial stuff going on together. You can have three or four dramatically different soil types sitting around it as a little neighbourhoods of farms on their own, on the same farm, frankly. So here we are. 62% of our national income is derived from primary production. That's quite different to the United States. It's different to pretty well any other country in the world. Over 90% of the food we produce is exported, always has been. New Zealand's 65,000 family farmers would feed a population significantly bigger than New Zealand. And when I say significantly, I mean very, very, very significantly. Now, 32% of internationally traded dairy products are traded under the brand of Fonterra, New Zealand's large corporate agricultural giant, which I believe is now buying up large tracts of the American dairy industry. And 30% of traded kiwi fruit is also traded under the banner of Zespri International Limited, our large corporate kiwi fruit exporter. So small country, but extremely agriculturally focused and really quite an important strategic actor in those particular fields. That's a sort of a picture of what New Zealand looks like in terms of sort of the distribution of pastoral. The yellow stuff's the pastoral. That's on the rain. That's on the drier side of the New Zealand, east side of the Southern Alps, the Great Divide. Dairy is concentrated usually on the west coast, but you'll see some of that red fungus sprouting up on the sides of the dry sides of the South Island here, all being created really out of irrigation. Our indigenous forests will come back. They've survived in little patches down here. And when you come and visit New Zealand, you're very unlikely to drive your camper van through here. You'll be driving down this last little bit through here and enjoying it very much. You're most welcome any time. Right, so land use in New Zealand, basically we have, it's a little small I'm afraid, but total pasture and arable land is about 52% of our land area, with plantation forestry another 5%, and horticulture sits in other land use at 90%. Natural forest is down to about 24%, having been 93% at the time of colonial encounter. So here we have the basic stats of New Zealand. In 2008, 38.5 million sheep, a few millions of dairy cattle and beef cattle making a big impact. Fruit, wine, forestry, and grains. Grains, it's up there to tell you we do nothing in terms of grains. And 4.4 million humans. 4.3... minus one, since I'm over here at the moment and the National Statistics Office is probably tracing my every movement. Right, most importantly, 99.8% of all beef production is fully pasture-raised. We had one feedlot, and it's gone through a number of owners as they're trying to make it economically viable, which is what happens to feedlots when you don't have subsidised cheap grain to feed the cattle. 100% of the sheep production is fully pasture raised. I just can't imagine a sheep feedlot. 100% of dairy production is predominantly on pasture. It has been done though. Someone tried it. I was proudly taken at a certain university I was visiting and shown the sheep feedlot, which I thought was... I thought maybe they were pulling my leg, so to speak, but it was for real. 100% of all dairy production is predominantly on pasture, with less than 5% starting to use high-protein supplementary feeding by importing palm kernels from the South Pacific, which has been very, very controversial. Right. What about the green options that are emerging in New Zealand? I started my career as a rural sociologist looking at the effects of radical deregulation of New Zealand agriculture in the 1980s. Our entire subsidy regime was completely removed in the 80s. The entire the favourable tax structure for farmers was taken away. It was basically, you know, out into the market, everyone, and see if you survive. And I was one of the many rural sociologists who said, we won't survive. Family farming is doomed, and history has proved me wrong. One of the unintended things that happened out of that restructuring period is New Zealand really experienced profound, quite dynamic change in terms of the orientation of a lot of our agriculture during that restructuring period, and emerged with some very important green options on the table. So New Zealand has emerged at the forefront of international trade and organic and what we would call EMS, environmental management system, branded foods. And why wouldn't you prosper when you can have scenery like that on the label of your supermarket in the UK? Now, looking specifically at the organic thing began taking off in the early 1990s and has been going like a train ever since. So this is a survey that we're just technically releasing in New Zealand next week, but you all will be able to keep the secret that long. So what we have is significant growth in particularly pasture that's moving under organics in the last 5 years. It's been a very significant shift. The number of organic licensees, operations and certificates, anyone who's in an organic certification organisation will know why those things are different, but it's interesting that so many new certificates in 2000, that's 2007 to 2009, if you can't see the numbers there. What it's really showing is a lot of the organic operators are suddenly diversifying and getting a whole lot of certificates for new activities. And the about just under 180 million New Zealand dollars worth of organic exports went out, but the growth curve's been rather promising for those industries. The New Zealand dollar used to have the kind of same relationship to the US dollar as the Canadian dollar had. It was a slightly more anemic version. But in recent times, I've noticed my buying power as a tourist in the States has gone up considerably as the North American peso plunges ever downwards. We haven't quite reached parity yet, but and for our agricultural exporters, we are desperately hoping for a turnaround in the fortunes of the US dollar soon because it's one of our three major traded currencies. We don't like it when it's low. All right, they're the major organic destination markets. You'll notice North America's come on very strong in the last two census periods to become our second most important organic market now. Here you have the effects of major economic slowdown in Japan. Australians have suddenly discovered New Zealand organic food. There is hope for the world. Right, alongside organic is the EMS schemes, the non-organic environmental management schemes, and these have also become extremely significant financially. We now have about $5 billion New Zealand dollars, which would be $4 billion US dollars worth of produce being exported under EMS schemes that are not organic. So we did a little survey of 2,000 national primary producers in the horticulture sector. 24% reported no involvement in an environmental QA or audit scheme. The other way around, 76% of them are now operating under a QA scheme. And by QA scheme, we just don't mean like a basic food safety or standard setting scheme. It's got to have some environmental, specifically marketed environmental criteria in it. And you have a quarter of all horticultural producers are involved in 3 to 4 such schemes simultaneously. For example, our kiwifruit industry, the 5% of the kiwifruit industry who are organic are also operating under the global gap assurance system to make sure they can get into those markets. Sheep, beef, it's slightly the other way around. In the pastoral industry, 63% haven't got into it yet, but a quarter of them again are starting to move into this area. It's been a lot slower. And I've written a lot in other and talked a lot in other venues about the rise of this great audit empire called Global Gap, which doesn't have a lot of presence in the States, but has a huge amount of presence elsewhere in the world. It's really taken over New Zealand horticulture as an environmental management scheme, and sustainable wine growing is another area which is going very well. Right, my basic argument is this. The main research project I'm involved in, what's called the Argos project, is a long-term study of 107 farms and orchards in triplet panels of organic, an EMS, and a conventional farm or orchard. I'll be talking about that primarily tomorrow in the symposium. And I think all three of them are creating a sort of a side of dynamism for New Zealand agriculture. They all bring slightly different things to the table. So we have conventional pastoral farming evolving within the grass-fed or pasture-raised model, and there is huge interest in New Zealand in the fact that the USDA is now, there's now this labelling scheme in the States, which is actually identifying sort of a free-range option for pastoral farming. And it really was, I did look at a little bit of the literature. I picked up that Union of Concerned Scientists report on the pasture option for stock in the United States, and I hadn't quite realised quite how much of your animal production had gone into into a feedlot or a CAFO system. All right, so they've got the conventional system there, which is starting to operate, and they're all looking very hungrily at that pasture-raised thing and thinking, excellent. Right, there's the environmental gap schemes, the EMS schemes like Global Gap and horticulture. You've got that $4 billion US dollars worth of exports happening around that. And you've got the ongoing evolution of the organic model in New Zealand, which continues to be kind of mark out one flank of the system. Now, what the Argos project is looking at in terms of these three is that it's very interesting, not necessarily to sort of, we are doing a huge amount of comparative work, you'll see that tomorrow if you come to the symposium, but also to look at the way in which there are synergies operating across these three. they're very interesting. I mean, when the pasture-based systems first began trying to take on a green market, who did they go to tell them how to do it? It was the those nutty organic growers who'd been sitting out the side all that time. And at the same time, what I'll go on to show in this talk is that the organic growers are actually picking up a number of things off some of our better conventional producers. I suspect by better conventional producers, I mean a different thing in New Zealand to what you might mean in the States or what COSA might think a better conventional producer was. All right, so looking first at the grass-fed kind of conventional model, let's put the best spin on it. The first thing is that that particular pastoral model, a very highly productive pastoral model, with a lot of quite a lot of environmental integrity still based inside it, and producing products that are still doing pretty well on the market. And New Zealand agricultural livelihoods have held up pretty well. No farmer will ever tell you that their livelihoods are going extremely well, but by international comparisons, we're doing quite well, really. Now, quite is a difficult word to use here. In the British and the American usage, it means something. I think we're doing okay. All right, there are still at this stage no major barriers to participation in basic conventional family farming in New Zealand. All you need to do is basically have a nose to pick up a huge amount of debt. There's very strong participation by women in New Zealand farming. A lot of our very innovative, this is not a new thing. I mean, New Zealand family farming has been a dynamic space for women for 120 years. We had a series of very strong women politicians that came out of family farming in New Zealand. New Zealand was the first country to give women the vote in the world. So, and farming was a hotbed of that kind of thing. It's something I'm very interested in the other part of my research career on rural gender. There's a very interesting space being carved out by Maori farmers, our indigenous First Nations there, and landowners who have, through government settlements and treaties, really a title over a large amount of productive landscape in New Zealand. And there's some very, very interesting models evolving there about indigenous labelling, because in some markets that is hot. I suspect there's markets in the States that will be very interested in indigenous labelling of Maori-branded products in the States. So there we have dynamic gender operating in New Zealand, where women learn how to drive tractors and... I lost my other one. Go back. My other photo died. I'm very disappointed. I had a famous picture of a man riding a cow. And... it's gone around the agricultural press in New Zealand. So women riding tractor, men riding cows. You see, this is part of the whole gender mix, dynamism, people thinking outside traditional roles, which creates new things happening. It's part of the way we guarantee our cows are fit for market cattle beasts, is that the farmers ride them into the abattoirs to make sure they're not stressed out. That is actually not true, but all right. We have a policy and trade environment that certainly seems to have encouraged farming systems that cater to consumers' better instincts. So there is an upper end of the market there that is paying a premium for green products. New Zealand is targeting that market. And I think New Zealand, even conventional farming, the grass-fed model, it demonstrates how highly productive pastoral farming can align itself to green values and create virtuous global-scale food systems. The Union of Concerned Scientists report baffled me at a number of key points, because it talked about the catastrophic loss of productivity that would happen if American farmers went back to raising their stock on grass. And I'm thinking, this news hasn't got through to New Zealand. When the subsidies come off your grain, which will happen eventually, we'll be there. We can tell you how it's done. This is mysterious. There's a dot appeared on my PowerPoint slide, and I've been trying to erase it. It's the ghost in the machine of this presentation. I've become obsessed with that dot on that cow. I'm thinking, is it some kind of special tracking device to monitor ruminant greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand? But I don't think it is. I think it's a little lurking thing there. All right, for New Zealand, it is now game on around food miles. I mean, the food miles issue is the issue of local food and food exporting has become absolutely critical. So a large amount of our own research group's investigation and a lot of other investigation in New Zealand is around energy auditing of food chains. And I think there's been a lot of very interesting research in the States about that as well coming on. That one's going to go and go, I think. No sign of anyone giving up on the food miles issue. There's certainly emerging problems of water quality emerging around dairy farming. So we have, as a passionate trout fisher myself, I don't like those things wandering into the trout stream. So there has been a lot of water degradation in some of the new areas that have got onto dairying in New Zealand, and a lot of politics emerging around that. You've got to also ask, can we have our temperate pastures, this fantastic kind of constantly bathed in rain, quite free-draining pastoral systems in New Zealand that are never too cold in winter, never too hot in summer. You can sort of have it all, except when Mother Nature throws a curveball at you. And so consumers don't like that. They don't like the version of that where the lambs are no longer standing upright. But a spring snowstorm in New Zealand can have severe effects because, of course, we don't winter over our stock and doors, which is why we have such an excellent energy profile compared to European farm produce. We don't provide central heating for our animals. But also, the way in which the dairy system is evolving in New Zealand, there have been massive productivity gains in dairying, but we have increased the amount of nitrate fertiliser we're putting on our pastures by about 600% over 10 years. And that's having an impact. So you got to ask yourself, you know, when you're thinking about the pasture-raised option, say for American agriculture, is any pasture, any system of agriculture at all, is subject to abuse if you just push it too far. So I think what New Zealand is in some ways is showing is two things in the pasture-based system. One, you can make a profitable life out of this. Family farmers can raise stock on grass and have a good life. But the second thing is you can abuse that system and push it too far. All right. Now, the question as to whether these things are really sustainable or not, I'm going to leave that hanging out there. If you're interested in how the Argos project is going in terms of comparing the sustainability of these systems, come on to the symposium tomorrow. Okay, what about, just to head towards a conclusion, what about New Zealand organics in the next 5 years? I've said it's a very dynamic sector. It's got a lot of very innovative and driven individuals behind it, very passionate individuals. Actually, they're all over the shop in New Zealand agriculture, or else they wouldn't stay in there. But there are it's a constantly moving target. So there are key areas of engagement around organic standards. We're having major discussion on organic standards about how to ensure animal welfare. What's happened, for instance, in some of our industries that have gone into the Global GAP Alliance, which comes out of Europe, there are major animal welfare codes in that alliance. So the IPM-style producers, the EMS producers, have actually, it's moved sideways from there into organic production, making sure that animal welfare standards. Worker welfare, obviously. Energy auditing is becoming an essential dynamic, will become an essential dynamic, and that's where the industry is at, energy auditing and water budgeting, because on those dryers, I mean, New Zealand is bathed in rain, except in the bits which are not. You know, the dry rain shadow areas on the east coast of New Zealand, water is a serious issue, and it's going to become an issue. Now, we're all arguing, the Argos Research Group is arguing for one more thing. We've had 6 years so far of an 8-year longitudinal study, 27 researchers, multi-million dollar budget. And if you had to boil it all down to one thing, it's about trees. Farmers who we see as being generally sustainable across the board plant trees. Farmers who don't, cut them down. Trees are an absolutely essential feature. It's almost the key issue for New Zealand because of we're a very disturbed ecology. New Zealand was a colonised landscape. As I said, it was 93% natural forest, natural bush, and we turned it into 52% pasturelands. Those old forests are our remnant endogenous ecosystem. And how farming, you know, and we've pushed it all up into the cold areas in the mountains, the places you'll go in, your camper vans, the glaciers, and it'll be beautiful. However, the place where those trees should be growing is down in the flush, warm, fertile areas. So here we have some photo shots from some of our Argos farms and orchards. So here we have one it's an IPM-based system. They've gone out of the practice of using Roundup to strip out the grass from between the vines because it was a stupid idea. But they haven't got much native stuff going on in there. But look here, here's one. I'm not going to tell you if this is an organic one or not, but they've basically built native vegetation and woody vegetation coming in here. You can see they're kind of the way in which I think these are avocados here. They're bringing a whole range of trees and creating a really quite a nice appearance there. And nice appearance brings nice ecosystem effects in New Zealand. In the pasturelands, that's kind of a tragic slide. That's the last dying giants of hardwood forests that were taken out. These would be the trees that survived the burning and just sit there. My friend, the ecologist, calls this sort of the march of the doomed ants. So there you have it. But here we have a farm that's been bought by a family of European bankers to turn into a model organic farm on our coastlands, one of our Argos farms. But you see in New Zealand the way in which the balance between top lands, which are being used for highly productive pasture, and the gully systems being used to regenerate the native bush around here, it's a very, very useful model. Why waste? You know, for a lot of our farmers, 80% of their costs were spent on 20% of their land. As one farmer said it, do you use Tordon brush killer here? Tordon, it's a brand of brush killer in New Zealand. He said, for all the Tordon, I could have filled up those gully with empty Tordon drums and the woody vegetation just kept coming back. Said, and in the end, it just worked out, let the woody vegetation come back. I'm wasting money in there. So you start to see in the pasture lands, you see these little enclaves of bush being regenerated in the gully systems. Again, this is one of our Argos farms, which is doing a nice little job. The sheepies are leaving it alone. All these little islands of the old dinosaur trees that have escaped out of here. These are Ents that have been corralled over here, which is nice to see. And here's one of our farmers who was part of the new fencing off of waterways, because the interaction between the trees and the waterways in New Zealand is very important. And here you see a farmer who's fenced off the waterways water system here. This is flowing down to join a trout stream down here, which I know very well myself in Southland. And they've put in natives, they're planting flaxes, although some pines have emerged in there. He's put pines on this slope. But it's the thing about Argos is that we are actually letting the farmers do what they want to do with these systems. We don't sort of climb in there and go, oh, I'd rather you hadn't put pines in. It's just marvellous to see your south-facing slope being planted. And even in our most conventional farms, I mean, a lot of the farmers are coming around to the idea that, you know, in an otherwise completely bare field, you know, a little stand of trees has some unintended side benefits for ticking off the animal welfare box on your European supermarket audit standard. So to conclude, if we're going to meet the Pretty Challenge, Jules Pretty's challenge to double agricultural productivity but do it sustainably, I would argue that three things need to happen. It's very reductionist, isn't it? Probably about 1,003 things need to happen. But here's the three I'm going to put up in front of you. All right, I think you need to have, I mean, the basis of so much of this evolution of a very dynamic green-based exporting industry across the border in New Zealand, so much of the technology and the experiments came out of the crazy nutters who were out on the edge of this thing at the start of the 90s. So there had been a very long-term but rather beleaguered organic movement. There'd been a hardy group of scientists who were very devoted to IPM systems and things like that. It was the crisis of the 1980s that really threw industries into realizing when the subsidies all went, that the people out on the fringes maybe were the gateway into the new market opportunities. I think those dynamic local-scale experiments must flourish. Second is that Jules Pretty would argue you can't solve world hunger without having massive elaboration of new agricultural models in the developing countries. I mean, the growth curves of agricultural productivity in the West, frankly, you can put some logarithmic scales up against them, but they began to tail off in the 1990s. That's why there was so much excitement around GMOs. I mean, really, our huge agricultural gains in terms of productive capacity in the West seriously started tailing off about 15 years ago. We have had our huge period of uptake. When you can take one small, well-designed legume-based system and put it into a Nigerian raised bed peasant village and increase their nutrient availability by 150% in a year, that is massive productivity uptake. The big uptake curve is sitting out there in the third world, and Jules Pretty is the kind of person who's working on how do you do that sustainably? Well, you do a lot of good science in the West, you try and ignore the bad science in the West, and you keep open dialogue between the areas. But I think, where is my place in this discussion? I think it's New Zealand, the job of places like New Zealand and those interesting enclaves that I've seen around the United States and other developed countries in the world is that we are trying to map out a future for highly productive family-sized farms that are looking to produce food sustainably. And that was basically Jules Pretty's final statement before he jumped on the plane in Dunedin and flew off on the equivalent of what I did a couple of days ago. You know, it's basically, you know, eventually the world is going to have to reach this point where you can do highly productive pastoral-based farming and do it sustainably, and we'll be fed and we'll be sustainable. Thank you. I get to escape now, or?
It takes some questions.
Oh, there were questions? I didn't know that was in my contract. I thought I was a politician. Kathleen. Well, it didn't remove agricultural subsidies.
Wasn't that the model?
Yeah, the neoliberal model. I mean, I think, yeah, it was a crisis that was profound. I mean, a number of us have made our careers as rural sociologists working on that particular crisis and what it did. What came out of New Zealand out of that crisis was some extremely creative things. And in that sense, exposing New Zealand to the market and exposing New Zealand particularly to a particular kind of evolving high-value market was very, very valuable. So in that sense, yes, taking the subsidies off was a good thing. If you threw up an intensification curve of the stocking rate of New Zealand pastoral farming, say in the sheep sector, it peaked out at the top in the last year that subsidies were there. It peaked out and then it's been coming back, de-intensifying ever since, and yet not losing value. In actual fact, it's been improving in value, which is that strange magic we can't seem to get our heads around in agriculture. Produce less and earn more. So the subsidies were driving, really, intensification of land use.
The iron is, he didn't support ending the subsidies here.
No, he didn't. No, we boldly went down that path. And 20 years later, we're okay. It's not nice getting there, though. Not nice for the politicians to get there.
So what you're saying is now, instead of subsidies driving that kind of intensification,
yes. I think if I was to put my, I mean, this is it's a model that's endlessly debatable, the New Zealand model. Thank goodness for me professionally. I mean, the thing about the pasture-based system and the intensification of that is that, in the end, you are very, very... I mean, the whole neoliberal system, if you want to get out of that kind of level of abstraction, the market-driven, no-subsidies, sort of dense food chains in which, even though they might be global in scale spatially, there's a lot of information flowing back and forward. The global gap criteria has 200 compliance points that our kiwifruit producers produce to produce the world's perfect kiwifruit. But their revenues have increased by 400% in 10 years doing this. So it's kind of a bit of a trade-off. We hate doing the audit. Actually, we like earning more money. It's that kind of thing. But the vulnerability of that system is always the vulnerability to a market-driven model. So New Zealand is basically catering to a literate market. I mean, it's a food-literate market. It's catering to people who want to buy what I call food from somewhere. It's catering to, food safety and environmentally conscious supermarket chains. And all that's great. The problem is the other market, the market that's driven by price alone, is a market that we can't serve under our model. And without subsidies, nor can anyone else. So that's what I think is the dilemma, is that your vulnerability to the market. They started going up all over the shop there. I've got two here. I think every growth trend in those at the moment has been escalating upwards. So New Zealand had two, at the time that the kiwifruit industry brought in the two first EMS, well, certified organic, plus what they called Kiwi Green, which became part of the Global Gap Alliance in 1994. In a survey in 2006, we had 32 schemes operating. Pretty well every country that's servicing high-value markets is going through the audit gateway, is going through those branded, certified, protocol-based, good agricultural practice gateways to market. I can't see them going away. Consumers like buying food that's got that level of assurance under it. I think the growth trend is up. What we see with the premiums is that, as one of our economists in the Argus Group describes, those schemes do not get you a premium in the market, they get you to the premium market. So it's not so much a case of will premiums hold up in the market, and this country itself is a very interesting place to look at those dynamics because your agriculture is so dominated by domestic factors. But for international trade, if you want to get to those premium markets, you've got to go through that gateway. Now, I think it's a highly problematic gateway. I think maybe I'm preempting a second question here, but something I've published on previously is that New Zealand is doing extremely well out of this. Countries that have kind of a first world kind of Europeanized, broadly sense, Anglo-Saxon style farming system, family farmers, all with computers, an ecosystem that frankly was imported from Britain into New Zealand and implanted there 120 years ago. We're doing really well at this. Third world producers are not. And third world producers really hurting. I mean, child labor standards, European style child labor standards, do not translate into peasant farming in Latin America or Africa. And that kind of thing. And those countries have the countries have gone to the WTO, they've gone to FAO and that and said, you've got to do something about this global gap and all this kind of stuff. It's really hurting us in the third world. And they turn around and say, we can't do anything about it. It's a private sector initiative. There's no governments involved in this whatsoever. We can't stop people wanting to go organic or wanting to go global gap or anything like that. It's a pack of supermarkets that designed those standards. The fact there's 81,000 producers producing under that is purely to do with what the private sector did. That, I think, is the big issue. Sorry, I held your question for a while.
No problem. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how countries, let's say in Europe, that have typically more than 50% of farm income coming from subsidies, mm. and places like the U.S. with maybe half of that, how we could move towards reducing subsidies. I mean, what do you see as some lessons learned from New Zealand that might be appropriate, or do you see any evidence of progress in that direction in places that currently have,
subsidy regimes? Certainly in Europe. I mean, the Europeans have been clever. They want to and the Europeans want to subsidize agriculture for another reason. I mean, I think most agricultural subsidies came in as part of the whole era of cheap food post-World War II. I mean, massive amount of economic growth in the world post-World War II has been because we basically made food cheaper. So that whereas 20 years ago, the average American household was spending 17 cents in the dollar on food, you're now spending 9.5. And that extra, those extra 9, 8, 8.5 cents has gone somewhere. It's gone to buy other stuff. I hope you spend it wisely. Whereas in Europe, it's different. I mean, Europe still has, that's Engels' law of economics, is how much you spend on food. In Europe, Engels' law is still higher than that. The French still pay somewhere near the equivalent of 20 cents in the dollar for food and consider it to be culturally essential to do so. So I think that the pathway out for Europe, I mean, they want to subsidize their agriculture because they want to keep a peasant farming sector basically there. They want the peasants in the hay carts driving down laneways in Burgundy and things like that. So they've shifted their subsidies from the blue box into the green box. And so they're subsidizing environmental qualities in these foods. And what's been fascinating over the last year is a massive harmonization effort now taking place in Europe in which the green box subsidies that were originally paid by government are now being ticked off as qualifying standards and criteria for the private sector market audits. So you're getting that synergy happening there. For the United States, you have huge dynamism at the local level and a whole lot of all over the shop. There's a whole lot of really exciting stuff happening in the States. But in terms of the big subsidy platforms, I don't know how much of your subsidies goes to big corporates anyway, frankly. And that's what tends to be the case for price support subsidies around the world. They're good lobbyists, I'll give them that. But the New Zealand model is not pleasant to look at in that regard because we went through massive pain and dislocation when those subsidies went. And our subsidies were way lower than American level subsidies when we started our reform period in 1984. So I think a new kind of New Zealand model was not emerging out of the carnage of the subsidy removal for about 10 years.
Can you comment on that restructuring that occurred during that painful period?
Wrote a whole PhD thesis about it. And I said, my confident last chapter, family farming is doomed in New Zealand, corporate agriculture is going to take over, was completely and utterly wrong. because, without subsidies there, farming's hard work. And, managing 300 sort of 150 to 300 hectare farms is an interesting business, and there's a lot of demand for our land. It's not cheap land. You can't buy up large tracts of cheap land. Yep, price support subsidies came off, special tax credits for developing marginal lands came off, special government subsidies for R&D came off, and everything just sort of ground to a halt. I think the year after that happened, sheep were being sold at the abattoir for $2 a head, much less than the price of transport. Farmers, there was huge protests of farmers slaughtering them. So, yeah, the whole culture of New Zealand farming collapsed, really, imploded. And what emerged out of that was some industries heading in very dynamic directions in one way. The Fonterra model is incredibly powerful, but doesn't serve a high value. It serves a food ingredients market, a completely different driver of the sort of the kind of organic phenomena. But the kiwifruit industry, probably the worst affected industry of them all, completely insolvent and bankrupt. It was an offer on the table from Dole to buy the New Zealand kiwifruit industry in toto to create kiwifruit chunks for canned fruit salad mix. But they went another way. There were dynamic actors in there who said, no, there's got to be a better way than that. We're not going to sell canned fruit salad mix. I sense agitation to move to the next stage. And those hands going up, they went up aggressively. And I got to think we ought to move on.
We can take questions after the round table.
There's one very keen person who's been there.
My question has to do with methane.
Yes.
And global climate change and animal-based agriculture and sustainability.
Mm. New Zealand is I'll put another slide up. New Zealand, the world leader of animal enteric greenhouse gas emissions. We do not have a solution for that. I think for the New Zealand dairy industry, it's a combination of enteric emissions plus the massive increase in nitrogen-based fertilisers. So the nitrogen, the NOxes, are a major source of greenhouse gases for our pastoral industries. So that we can do something about. There's a cow in the Dairy New Zealand has identified called Maisie or Elsie or something, which is naturally producing 40% less greenhouse gases. Now, they're trying to work out whether it's the gut bacteria, whether she's just mutated that way or whatever. And once they've worked out what it is, they're going to multiply that cow through the New Zealand dairy herd as fast as possible. Fingers crossed on that one for our dairy industry. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I hate to cut off the questions, but there'll be time after the roundtable discussion and then tomorrow at the symposium again. But thank you so much, Hugh, for that window on a whole different kind of agriculture and possibly a lot of models for us. I mean, really, ints notwithstanding, I think we got the ring. My job here is to initiate the next part of the of tonight's activities, which is the actual roundtable discussion. So, based on what you heard from Hugh, he discussed different models for sustainability and specifically addressed the controversies over the organic standards in New Zealand. We would like you to take on a couple of questions about organic standards. We'd like you to divide up into groups and assemble at the tables there at the back of the room, and talk among yourselves about a couple of questions. I'll give them to you in a moment, but I want to tell you that there will be a moderator for each table that can help lead you through this and record what you're saying. And you'll report your moderator or someone in your group will report back to the whole group up here in about half an hour or so. Okay. So, could the moderators identify themselves, raise their hands? Okay. So they're going to be at each of the tables, and they'll help you get through this. And here are the questions we'd like you to pursue. Two questions. First, what additional standards or metrics should organic agriculture support, aside from the current organic production practices standards? Such as fair trade, carbon footprint, slavery, social justice footprint, methane production, and riding cows, whatever you want to think about. And the second question we'd like you to consider, if we could provide input to the National Organic Program regarding these additional metrics, how would we propose they be regulated? Okay? So your moderators will have copies of these questions at the tables. So if you could distribute yourselves among those tables and talk about this. Okay, I'd like to ask you to wrap things up and get the moderators or whoever's reporting from your respective tables to come up and share what you've talked about with us. I know, it's hard to stop. I don't know who they are. Are you one? Oh, okay. Well, let's just start with this table over here. You folks over there, who's going to come up and report on what you're talking about? All right. Aaron. Why don't you come up here, please?
Hi. We had a really good discussion over the FAR table in terms of what additional standards, metrics should organic agriculture support to improve the standards. We had a long discussion about recycling human waste and trying to find ways to incorporate human waste into organic production systems, particularly because with the distances that food travels, oftentimes the nutrients that are removed from a farm in the form of food don't find their way back to that farm. So we talked also about how to recycle other types of waste and not just human manure. We talked about a lot of things. Okay. I'm summarizing. We talked about energy use, the importance of trying to include energy calculations in the standards. We talked about the issues of regulations themselves and the fact that the National Organic Program, the regulations say that all the things you can't do, but don't really look at what a good holistic organic system should be, and that inspectors spend a lot of time going through a list of, records and papers instead of spending time out in the field. And then we ended up the conversation talking about carbon sequestration and how to figure out how to use metrics to include in the standards, particularly because the current tools available through agencies like NRCS are significantly weighted against organic just in the way that they measure the metrics that they do.
Here, here for table number one. Table number two. Pat?
Okay, you guys can correct me when I didn't get this right. We talked about a lot of things, too, in the 5 minutes that we talked. So I think initially the one thing that was articulated in the group was there already is quite a bit of regulation, bureaucracy, and paperwork associated with the organic standards, and perhaps we want to think pretty hard before we add to the bureaucracy and the paperwork that already is in place. And then I think Erin Silva, I think the group felt she provided some pretty good insight. maybe before also additional metrics are used or identified and then incorporated into guiding organic agriculture, some thought needs to go into exactly what is organic agriculture as we move into the future. Is it simply a marketing tool? Or is it more than that, and is organic agriculture a way to move to where we want to be, and not just what we identify as organic agriculture today, but to move towards better systems? So did I say that?
Yeah, but did you have
long? Yeah, I think, yeah, we did. Okay, Kathleen, table number 3.
Thank you, table number 2. Yes, the gauntlet has been thrown down to table number 3 now.
Well, I think we focused on the questions, but I came into the discussion about 5 minutes late, so I missed the first 5 minutes. But our table talked mostly about the option of using the energy audit as a standard for or a metric for inspecting organic systems or organic farms or whatever you want to say that question is there. And there was I'm sorry, but I have to do this. There were some options that were thrown out. For instance, how are we going to actually do this audit physically? What is it going to entail? Some discussion about a traditional life cycle analysis for energy, but it's very, very cumbersome. Is there a way that we can define or identify energy efficient practices that we can then somehow quantify? And then we kind of got sidetracked a little bit. And this is when I came in. We were talking about, it's hard for me to figure out where we were at. We were talking about how many hours it took for a farmer to actually get all the paperwork put in just for the current standards. And there were estimates from 3 hours to 4 hours to up to 100 hours of time just to fill out the paperwork for the current standards. And there was a lot of discussion and concurrence that a lot of the farmers aren't choosing to get certified because the paperwork is just too much trouble, okay? And then we shifted back to energy audit again and energy practices. And we acknowledge that it's sort of a sticky slope because it's possible that organic practices are going to end up being a little bit higher on the energy balance than some other conventional practices, possibly. I'm not sure that's true, but it could be. So we thought it might not be a good idea to compare with conventional, but find some other metric for comparison. And then we really got zen and started talking about personal motivation and self-directed accounting, and that the information that each person needs to direct themselves and to stay honest. And then we talked just very briefly about a way to kick out some crude energy balances. The model Russell can actually do that for the field scale, so that might give a farmer an opportunity to do that. Oh, duh. Thank you. Two. And then for the last 5 minutes, we focused on how could we possibly enforce any kind of standard, especially an energy audit. And once again, we talked about personal integrity and that the inspectors are probably looking for personal integrity and they look for simple things that they check when they come to your farm. And we talked quite a bit about that, but then a really good point was made, and that is for energy, You don't have the touch, feel, and sniff options that you do with the current standards, where you can't actually stick your head, you know, into the box and see whether or not you smell the telltale sign of a pesticide. There's no way to get physical evidence. And then there was a small discussion again about personal integrity. And then we ended up with, everyone on our table agreed that this was a good idea, and that is that maybe the inspector or the certifier is probably not the best person to be checking for the energy audit or doing the energy audit, because they're really not actually allowed to provide any information. They're just inspecting, and that perhaps we could encourage some sort of entrepreneurial enterprise where we form a little new business for people to come in and audit farms and do an energy audit and provide the information to the inspectors, who can then provide the agency with the inspection information. That's it.
Thank you. Table number three. Now, table number four, that's a tough act to follow. It's hard to beat Zen. But Liz is going to do it.
Okay. Well, come on, even the bartender knew you got the question last week. So he's hiding now. I'm like, come on, this is serious. Well, we had Jim at our table, so we didn't even have to really get into that area. We just really did question number one. And we were talking about better matrix for assessing soil. We were interested in what they were doing at the NRCS in organics, and we felt like there was a, you know, they needed to get a lot of knowledge from us, you know, educators and research institutes, to help them develop that program. There needs to be more of an inter-exchange between those two agencies. Is that kind of it? Sort of. Okay. NOP. Okay. And then we had a nice young lady I met last year from Cornell, and she's developed really nice, we were really into the dirt on this table, the Cornell Soil Health Test, and we're looking at that. She says it looks at the biological, physical, and chemical makeup of the soil, and it's a test that's available for the public. She took it to Africa, and she said it was a transferable technology or test to, you know, a totally different place than Cornell. So that was kind of interesting. So we were kind of focusing back on the, well, Stefan had Oregon Tilth, and he said basically, they don't have any, was it the soil standards, right? They don't have any assessments to go by. So, you know, nothing to validate their inspections. And then, so we basically focused on measuring and quality standards and things of that. Jim talked a little bit about carbon sequestration, that organic, you know, should maximize carbon sequestration in the system. Did I get that right? And quantify it, okay. So, and we pretty much, that was it. And we tried to talk about labor standards, but then we got into the area where how can you regulate what you do with your wife or your husband, and that was a little bit weird. So, you know, then we decided that it cannot be regulated, but I thought there were some senses it could, and we didn't have another 5 hours to argue that out. But, so that's kind of it for us. I don't know how you guys really got all that in your session, but we were probably just thinking more.
Okay, there's fodder for you to take home. You can all spend hours talking about how to regulate your wives and husbands after we leave. So table five, last but not least, we have a representative.
So we also had some similar themes going on at our table. It sounds like this idea of using some type of soil quality standard and something that our table emphasized that it needs to be over a long period of time, and that, you know, just doing an input substitution type system is not really key or core to what we considered to be the meaning of organic agriculture. We also talked a little bit about what we thought organic ag meant versus what the standard actually enforces. And so some of the things that people consider to be organic ag, but there really isn't a measure of, is things like it being a small farm. So how do you define that? Some type of social justice issue, and then this concept of sustainability that many of you brought up, like possibly using a life cycle assessment. So we felt that of the three legs of the stool that's sustainable ag, you know, there's the agricultural science, the economics, and the social justice, that the easiest one to regulate that we would start with is still these measures of some type of sustainability from a scientific aspect, where we're trying to quantify, you know, biodiversity. So what does that mean? Is it enough just to use a cover crop, or does that cover crop have to increase, you know, soil organic matter over the long term? And so, like many of you, we felt, you know, using some type of standard where we pair the organic certification with natural resource conservation standards would probably be the most efficient. And we talked a little bit too about the fact that a lot of the monies that the farmers can tap into through NRCS are related to structural components, or, you know, buffer strips. But sometimes a farmer doesn't try a new cover crop because they don't have the money even for the seed for the cover crop. So changing the structure, you know, of the the funds might be of value to some of these growers, you know, looking more at the biological shifts as opposed to some of the more mechanized shifts. And so as far as carbon footprints or carbon sequestration, we all felt like that was related to these soil quality parameters, but that trading carbon is kind of a dangerous game, because, you know, one ecosystem is different from another, so you can't just trade one unit of carbon for another, and how on earth are we going to figure that out as part of the standard? And so I had mentioned that the Washington State Department of Ag, most of the certification goes through them or Oregon Tilth, and so the WSDA standard is really high for our state. And one of the nice things, you know, about that is that you have this third party that's kind of looking over the shoulders of industry, because a lot of the certification goes through private companies. And so I think our guest speaker touched on this neoliberalism, and that's one thing that we kind of wrapped up on and incorporated with the social justice aspect, that can you rely on, you know, an entity that the average person hasn't voted or agreed to enforce a standard to protect our interests as a population. So for food safety and for food quality, do we just want to assume that if we pay top dollar for something, that that's going to be assured? And so, you know, how we enforce the standard is important, because it used to be that these small farmers organizations would self-regulate, and there were some issues there too, you know, some infighting, and you always had to be careful about whether so-and-so was going into a farm that they had a connection to. But, you know, there's the other flip side too, when you have a system that's largely input substitution and driven more by 100% market. And that was another concept that came up at the table. Why was the market the driver? You know, why did that control so much of the organic standard? And I think, you know, maybe because growers needed to make a profit and they had to have that value added. And so it was a very short time period. We felt like we would have liked to have had more time. You know, we would have liked to have talked about how to quantify even some of these tiny little things like the cover cropping aspects, but that agriculture is so large and there are so many diverse systems that we have to put under the umbrella of the certification. And as all of you guys pointed out, a lot of the growers are fed up with even filling out a tiny form. And one of our group mentioned that, you know, 100 hours to fill something out, a lot of people that put that down, they probably haven't even tried to fill out the form. But, you know, what is the incentive for filling out the paperwork to begin with when, you know, you have these alternatives to organic, or you can say non-certified organic, and still, you know, you have your group of loyal people that, you know, come to buy your produce at the market. And so I think there's a lot of things that have to be addressed, but I think there's a lot of dedicated and interested people that have a lot of passion and energy, and hopefully will improve on the existing standard. So, thanks.